Hi, this is Leo, and if I want to know what's happening in Linux, hey, I'm going to listen to the Linux Link Tech Show.
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show! Tech Show! Tech Show! Yeah!
The Linux Link Tech Show is on.
Is on.
Your link to GNU Linux and the latest technology. 2 hours of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Free software, free speech, open technology,
and open mic.
I love it.
Now, live from the Linux Link Tech Show studios, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away.
Hi, this is Pat Davila from the Linux Link Tech Show, and we're back after lunch here at Ohio Linux Fest, and I've got Catherine Devlin joining me. Catherine, welcome to the show. It's nice talking to you.
Thank you.
So you're a big Python programmer.
I'm not a very intense programmer, but I'm incredibly enthusiastic about Python. So,
what is it about Python that you really like?
There are a lot of great things about it. What I personally like the best is the readability. I feel like code that I've written in Python I can come back to and read, and code that other people have written I can come and understand and use very easily, which is what gets me excited.
What kind of programming have you done with Python?
I'm a database administrator, so most of what I've done connects one way or another to a database. Either it's going in and manipulating data, or it's live web applications that are used to insert and retrieve from the database.
And you like using Python strictly for that?
Yes, definitely. Of course, within a database, it's Oracle databases that I use, and those run PLSQL stored procedures, which are, well, I like Python.
Now, I remember last year you did a pretty good talk, and you were doing, I think it was a... Was it a collision simulator?
Thank you. It was a simulation of solar system gravitation, including collisions, because
right.
I didn't make a stable solar system. I just sort of sent planets going randomly until they smashed.
That's interesting. How do you even come up with, like, calculating what the weight and mass is of the different objects?
I'm married to a physicist, so
there you go.
Yeah, that part comes pretty naturally. Just take a M1, M2 times big G over R1 plus R2.
Okay.
But I use a Python library called Visual Python, which fortunately includes predefined vectors, and those vectors obey vector mathematics. So you just say V1 plus V2, and they add, and you don't worry about, X1 plus X2, and so on and so forth. Sorry. You don't worry about every vector having independent dimensions. It handles all that. It's an example of a piece of Python code that just simplifies a lot of things.
So if somebody's implemented all these difficult things already.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And it does the graphics too. So
now you hear about, like, NASA using Python.
Mm-hmm.
You hear about, you know, rocket and engineering type people using it. What are some of the other applications that people develop using Python?
Oh, well, you've probably heard that Google is deeply into Python these days. And they have, for instance, most of that, of course, is on their end, although they do have the Google Application Engine these days, which is a way that you can develop a web application in Python and deploy it on Google servers, and it's free up to a reasonable point. Then, of course, they hope that you'll become
charging.
The next big thing and start charging you for it.
Right.
Let me see. I ought to have more examples of this to roll off the tip of my tongue.
Right. Where I work, we do mostly Java development, and
mm-hmm.
We do some web-based stuff using Enterprise Java Beans.
Okay.
And what we have is we have a whole bunch of build scripts using Python to build the environment. Anytime we have an application that we want to build for a particular environment, we'll run the Python scripts, and everything is all automated and works very, very well.
Right.
To use it.
Right.
And that's more of a scripting kind of a thing, where it's an admin.
Yeah, most people think scripting when they think Python, and of course it's great for that. But it's also great for really large projects. And actually, most Linux distributions these days have a great amount of software that is built in Python. Ubuntu recommends that people work with Python when they submit new things. The Sugar XO operating system is Python.
a lot of Python.
Yeah, right? Yeah, very, very heavily Python.
You see, my interest in Python. Go ahead, Dan.
Is this on?
Yes, it's live.
Oh, isn't there particularly, and I think Ubuntu, aren't they working towards making the startup process of the operating system based on Python?
I believe so, although I can't tell you any details. That's actually an angle of Python that I would love to see a good presentation on, because I haven't gotten into hacking Linux itself, and I know that some people love to, and that is a big area where Python is used more and more, but you know, just not one I've had a chance to explore.
Now, for me, as an application developer, I'm leaning more towards what you do.
Okay.
Where you have a database with a front-end client, you know, doing whatever you need to report, you know, whatever.
Right.
And I've been looking at different widget sets, and I've been kind of leaning towards WXPython.
Okay.
I know there's also Qt has some, and there's also native GTK.
You've researched it pretty well,
yeah. Which ones do you tend to favor?
I don't do a lot with client-side GUIs, and so I've only played a little bit with WX, and that seemed nice. You can also do things, what is the name? Glade, for instance.
Right.
I've
got WX Glade on here.
Okay, yes.
Right, to do layouts of widgets and how your app looks.
Right, and I think that looks pretty easy entry. Most of what I've done is more web-oriented, and I could talk more about that. But.
Well, when we talk about Python and web, there's specific frameworks out there, right?
There are.
Django, Soap,
yes.
What are some of the other ones?
Well, TurboGears happens to be my favorite. Django is definitely the one that gets the most press, for some good reasons. Probably 3 or 4 years ago, there was this terrible thing in the Python community where everyone was writing their own web framework. Django has pretty much settled out to be the most popular, although TurboGears, Zope are distinctly up there. Web2Py is a new one that's really, really well documented, and I swear its author must spend his whole life documenting and promoting it. So I guess there are still people making new ones.
So Python really is like a three-headed monster when you think about it. You have the scripting side of it that a lot of admins use.
Right.
You have the standalone application using whatever GUI toolkit.
Right.
And then you have the web-based applications.
Right. And it all, those are kind of the main things you see it involved in, or at least the ones that come to the top of my head. It is extremely general purpose. So honestly, anything except the sort of super CPU-intensive stuff you can do with it. It's just a question of what people have found it useful for.
Now, one weakness that I've heard other people describe Python is that it doesn't support parallel processing, multi-threading. Is that correct?
Oh, there. Let me think about this. I'm going to get it. Python has a global interpreter lock, and that is controversial among the sort of people who understand what that is, one of whom I unfortunately am not. You can certainly run processes in multiple threads. I don't know how the concurrency works. It has a built-in module in its standard library to run, you know, separate processes. That part goes fine. Now, how those processes share a single CPU, I'm sorry, I can't tell you the details on. It is not a functional language, which I understand are, well, I'm not sure. Now, I do know that if the global interpreter lock is a big concern, that some of the variants of Python don't actually have that. For instance, there is Jython, which is Python for the Java platform.
Right.
So you can use Java's capabilities there.
And use the Java toolkits.
Yes. And Jython, as of a year ago, I would have said that Jython had almost gone to sleep. And since then, it has really woken up. They have jumped from falling well behind the main branch of Python development.
Right.
And now they've got a 2.5 out there, which is basically what you're likely to be using. And, of course, Sun has employed some people full-time to work on Jython development now. So that's moving again, which is exciting.
It seems that for a developer, Python really has become one of the hot technology, one of the languages to really jump on. It seems it has a real bright future ahead of it.
I think so. And one of the things is, you don't have to deeply commit. You really can just jump in and try a little bit and get something useful done. There's not a clean line between you are or are not a Python person. You can be just as much of a Python person as you need to for whatever particular project.
In other words, somebody can hack up something fairly reasonable, quick amount of time.
Right, right.
Not have a high level of expertise at it.
Right, and yet, if you come back to that a year later with a little more expertise, you probably won't be too ashamed of what you did.
Right. The code lends itself to be fairly tight and
right.
well written.
Right. It kind of pushes you toward good practice.
Now, going forward, I know the Python 2.6 release just came out.
And yes.
Going forward, Python 3000.
Yes.
What are some of the things that are changing in the language going forward?
From the point of view of the average programmer, you're not going to see a lot of changes. It's a little bit radical in the sense that it breaks backward compatibility, which hasn't happened for a very long time.
Yeah, that tends to piss up a lot of people off.
Yeah. On the other hand, it's really not hard to fix that backward compatibility. There are, in fact, I believe there's a toolkit that can do the process almost automatically.
Right. There's some reporting things where it'll automatically flag what needs to be changed. Mm-hmm. And I think there's even some automated tools that will convert
yes.
the code for you.
Yes. But I've seen it. I've played with it a little bit. It does not at all feel like a different language. It's not... You're not going to feel like it's a whole new world. There's just a few inconsistencies in the way objects are defined, exceptions are handled, a few other really relatively minor things that have been cleaned up so that little quirks that didn't quite fit the overall theme have been cleaned up. But it's not that different. And, of course, the main reason for doing Python 2.6 is that you can write Python 2.6 with all of Python 3.0's features. So that's really meant to be a bridge release, a transitional release. You can...
So you have a chance to fix what's going to be broken.
Exactly. And yet keep running... That way you can keep running on a Python 2 platform and yet just throw the switch when you're ready to go to 3.0.
So Guido Van Rossum really has done a pretty mock-up job of looking forward and how to implement a changeover.
I think so. And, of course, even though he is the benevolent dictator for life... It's not a one-person show at all anymore.
Of course, there's a big group behind it.
There's a very big group of core developers, but they do, they're big, but they are tightly, they cooperate like crazy, and so I suppose it still has a lot of coherence.
Now, I know one of the things you're involved with, what is it, PyOhio?
PyOhio, yes. This is a new regional conference. We did it for the first time last January. We got about 90-some people. Had a great time. Everyone enjoyed the talks. The main thing they wanted was more time to hang out with each other. And so we're going to do it again next summer and go for 2 days instead of just one.
That's fantastic. What are some of the things you do in talks?
It's kind of a microcosm of the National Python Conference. So there's regular scheduled talks. And then there's open space sessions, which are, you throw them together informally and discussion crops up whatever you like. Oh, let me think. We're going to see what people do with the open spaces. We need to manage those a little better this time because for a lot of people that's unfamiliar and they're not sure what to make of it.
Yeah, I'm looking to take some Python classes myself, and if the conference has some classes, I might be inclined to come to that.
One thing we definitely want to do next time is have something very beginner-oriented, hopefully at the beginning of the conference, so that that can get you up to speed, and then you can fake your way through as a more intermediate programmer by the time you're done with that, which honestly is not that unrealistic in Python.
So for someone new, what do you think is the best way to do it? Get a book on Python?
I've never found there are a lot of books. I can't tell you a particular one that stands out. Honestly, there are a lot of websites that do an excellent job of walking you through. A Bite of Python is a well-known one.
Right.
I believe that's the one that's more geared toward people who already know some programming. I have a sheet of resources at the PyOhio table that I didn't bring
with me. Right, you can also go to python.org and they have a lot of links there.
Yes, python.org is the center
the place
of the,
to go.
Yes, the center of the Python universe.
Excellent. It's really great. I really like Python, what I've seen of it so far. I like the direction of where it's going. I like the flexibility of it. And if someone comes up to me and they say, what language do I learn as my first programming language? I think Python has to be in the top one or two.
Thank you. I'd agree with that. These days, Python is the first language that computer science majors get at MIT.
Woo. Really?
Yes, it is. It is.
So they're not going with .NET anymore.
Oh, go please.
It's a joke. It's a joke.
Thank you.
You know what's scary, though, is I've talked to people who've gone through different degree programs at different universities, and they tell me that C# and .NET was the center application language that they were pushing them through. And
yes.
That is exceptionally scary when you think about it.
It is. It is. I have seen that myself, and that should be a whole topic of a discussion because that, I don't know, it doesn't even seem ethical to me to train students whose entire skill set belongs to one company.
Vendor, yep.
That's...
Well, when I did
that all comes in with grease in the palms.
Of course.
The business model that Microsoft has surrounding their education system.
Sure.
I mean, it's...
It would help, though, that a high-level academic program would be above that.
And I think that, for the most part, I think that the degree to which... Oh, this is going to sound really incendiary. I think that the amount of knowledge a professor has about the IT world as a whole sort of determines how vulnerable they're going to be to any one particular company trying to swoop in and say, well, you know, we'll just take you by the hand and lead you through it all, and you just follow us and trust us. I think the ones who are more in tune with everything that goes on in IT are more likely to say, no, that's not broad enough for my students.
You see, coming from someone who's worked in IT for 15 years, I tend to tell people that you really should be building applications with a language that is as cross-platform as possible.
Yes.
You shouldn't be tied to any particular platform, should be tied to any particular vendor.
Right.
And Python is truly one of the most cross-platform programming languages. They are.
It is. I've never heard of a platform. I'm sure somewhere there is a platform that it doesn't run on, but I've never heard of it.
And it seems it's being ported to other platforms. I know a lot of the embedded devices, like the Nokia.
Yes. Oh, that's right. That's right.
They run Python applications on there.
Yep. Yep. Some phones and mobile devices and the works.
It's great. It's good times ahead.
Yeah, I think so.
I thank you for coming. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
I remember your talk last year being one of the best ones that I saw.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
And hopefully you'll present again in the future.
I'm rerunning last year's talk at 4:00. It's not one of the formally scheduled talks, but just in one of the BOF rooms and I'm opposite Mad Dog again. That's okay. I'll see him someday.
A Python discussion.
Again, the Python introduction, yes.
Very good. Might have to come over and check that out.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Hey, guys.
Hey, it's Klaatu. Klaatu flew in from Los Angeles.
Yes. Yes, I did. How's it going? You got a booth?
Oh, it's a table.
Yeah, not for anarchists, pal.
Yeah.
All right.
Can you commit to this?
I'm an anarchist, and I'm taking your water. Because it's free. It's for everyone.
I was sure, man.
Thank you.
You know we're the most... We try to be generous and friendly with the other guys.
You guys are. I see you've got some Linux Basement and a lot of Linux Link stickers.
Yeah, those guys are mooching off our table.
I know. I don't.
We had to pay for this table, and they're mooching off of us now.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
So, what do you think of this, man? You've gone to Scale, which is a Southern California Expo.
Yeah.
What other conferences have you been to?
Scale. Oh, bar camps, like little Nauticon type
presented
things.
At these.
What's that?
You presented.
Yeah, I did actually. Yeah, no, you know what? I mean, this place, this Ohio thing is, I would say, bigger than Scale in terms of, like, size. And honestly, I want to say attendance, too. I don't know.
The number I heard this morning was around 1,000. I think they're above that.
Yeah.
I think their target was around 1,200, I think they were shooting for this year.
Yeah.
Which is pretty large.
Quite large.
For community.
Yeah, totally. But it's impressive. I like it. It's neat. It's fun.
Have you gotten to any of the talks?
No, not yet. I've been preparing for a Birds of a Feather meeting that I was going to hold on anarchists and Linux.
You're an anarchist.
I am an anarchist. I really am. I believe in it. And I believe that Linux is the perfect representation of anarchy in action.
Now, let me ask you.
Okay.
There've been attempts of an anarchist-type government in the past. I know my family is Spanish from Spain, and during the Spanish Civil War...
Yeah.
In Barcelona in particular, a bunch of anarchists took control over there.
Yeah.
And it didn't go too well.
No, it didn't. But that was partially because the government attacked them.
Well, one of the governments.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that, I mean, like, if you look at the Linux community, in my view, I mean, I don't think that anarchy, I don't think we should just switch over right now, right? But I think that Linux, in the way that it doesn't have any kind of leadership and it doesn't have any focused
You're like a decentralized
control.
type of
Exactly.
Setup.
Very decentralized and very participatory, because right now, I don't know if it's a part of democracy or capitalism or what it is, but there's a certain degree of, like, just this consumerism mindset where we all just want to consume and consume and consume and we don't want to give back, blah, blah, blah. If you look at the Linux community, it's all about giving back.
Yes.
It's all about participating and saying, let's rely on our own solutions.
Exactly.
Like, you guys, you don't use, like, freaking TalkShoe for your show. You know,
no.
You've got your
Never.
Own servers.
Never.
Unlike
some other group.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And we're running all open source and free software to do our show.
Yeah.
You know,
is that that's a nice butt right there?
That's
actually
an awesome butt.
That
man.
Really
that
is
a tight butt.
Okay, but yeah, so Linux in that sense, I think is a really it's like a real world. It's a successful anarchy
absolutely.
Right now.
To a certain degree, yeah.
To a certain degree, and I know there are companies that are contributing and all that other good stuff. Totally.
What's your feeling on proprietary? What's your feeling on proprietary applications on top of Linux?
I think it's wrong. I think it's stupid.
Can you commit to that?
Yeah, I will. I'll commit to that. I will, totally.
Now, does that, do they come and take your anarchist card away because you've committed to that?
No, I've... What?
I just made an idiot. But
I get you. Oh,
how do you
very
how,
clever.
How do you
snuck
feel,
up on me.
How do you feel about proprietary applications? You think it's a good thing or a bad thing?
Honestly, I think it's a bad thing.
You do?
I really do. I don't think that there's any need for it. I think that it's just companies being paranoid, being protective, wanting to lock you in. And I don't think they need to. I think a good company could be open source. It will be open source, and they will still get your business because their product is good, you know?
Now, you do a lot with video.
I do a lot with video,
and
yeah.
You are a graphic designer by trade?
No, I'm really more of a video editor. I've worked
video
at, like,
editor.
UPN and Oxygen Networks.
You have done some really interesting episodes.
Thanks.
About the ones that stand out to me about using Blender as a video editor application.
Yeah, yeah.
What's your general feel for the state of video editing under Linux?
I mean, I think that it's got a long way to go, mm-hmm. Especially like it's the whole Photoshop versus GIMP type of thing, you know? Like, well, yes, it can do it. But if you're going to like try to attract someone used to, for instance, Final Cut Pro to Linux, the only option they're going to have is like Smoke from Autodesk, which is proprietary. It's bound to the hardware. It's like 50K or something like that. It's like it might be more than 50K for a workstation.
I was going to buy a copy next week. So
yeah, good. Because I can timeshare if you want. But, yeah, you know, I mean, it's got a long way to go. But I think that the brightest light right now is Blender. I mean, it's a great program. It's
great
flexible.
Project.
It's a great project. You're seeing examples of it right now. You know, I mean, there's Big Buck Bunny and there's Elephant Stream. You know, I mean, they've got product to show, you know.
Yeah, one of my sister's friends works in the industry in Hollywood.
Oh, okay.
And he's a, you know, special effects animator type guy.
Cool.
And he saw that, and he was blown away at the level of what Blender can do.
Wow, that's cool. And it can. And it's flexible enough where they've got the non-linear editor right there. Not many people know about it, and it is not a traditional, like, you know, if you put someone in who's used to Final Cut in front of that, they're going to freak out.
Weren't you using Cinelera for a while?
No, I was not.
You never used
Cinelera. I tried it.
It's a sick interface.
It's freaking awful. It's terrible.
My take on the whole video thing is like, Kino is a great like home video
yeah,
type of thing.
Yeah.
I've used it quite a bit for home videos. You know, it's the type of thing where you have a home video camera. You pop the camera, you put your tape in there, you hit play, you've got it piped into your FireWire.
Yep.
You capture the video, do a little minor editing. You burn a DVD.
Yeah.
It works great for
yeah.
that. And then on the high end, we have something like Cinelera or maybe something like even Blender.
I think Blender.
And it seems where Linux is really lacking right now for video editing is in the middle.
Yeah.
And I know Padivi is a project that seems to go, you know, it seems to go gangbusters for a while, and then it slows down.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's one of these GStreamer-based applications.
Yep.
There's a couple other ones, too. I know there's Cadian Live is another one.
Yeah, Cadian Live is pretty cool.
Right.
But it's, yeah.
It seems that the middle sweet spot where someone who has some experience with it wants to do a little more, but they're not quite professional.
Yeah. Well, you know what I think about that? And I was talking to Dan about this last night, and I don't know. I'm not a programmer, so I don't know yet. So I don't know the logistics or the reality, you know, how realistic this would be. But what if some – I think it would be cool if some coder took the Blender code and kind of like stripped away all the extra stuff that it can do and kind of like just focused on the video editing portion and kind of develop it into its own.
So you're looking to hijack the product and fork it, basically.
Yes, exactly.
you're not interested in the animation piece, which is really what it's known for.
Exactly.
You know what, though? You're not the only person that I've heard recommend Blender for doing video editing.
Yeah, it's
especially
serious.
High-definition video editing.
Yes, yes, exactly.
And everything's going high-def. That's
yeah,
now
I mean,
in the
yeah,
future.
Totally. Yeah, yeah.
So you've worked in the industry. Let me ask you, what do they use? Do they use proprietary stuff? Do they use in-house stuff? Is it a mix?
It's it's very rarely in-house. Well, except the big animation
right, they
companies,
have their own
you know, like yeah, yeah. But in terms of video editing, like for like my experience is, like I say, UPN and Oxygen Networks, and invariably they had been Avid based. By the time I started working for them, they were pretty much almost all Final Cut Pro. Final Cut Pro really moved in there and just kind of took over
it
that industry.
Hollywood is all Apple now.
It's all Apple
not,
now.
Not just like the video people, but like the audio people as well as like the writers.
I made a lot of money in Hollywood teaching Avid editors how to use
right.
Final Cut.
Right.
Like
seen,
that was where
I've seen some of your tutorials.
Yes.
On that
yeah,
stuff.
At kinstone.net.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
No, totally. That's like I make a lot of money on that stuff.
There's a big demand for that out there.
There's huge demand. I would get editors from CBS, from just all over the place saying, look, I know Avid like the back of my hand. They're wanting me to know Final Cut and do my own mixdown and, you know, and you're just like, oh, and export it for the web. All of a sudden, the editor is no longer just like one part of the workflow. They're like a couple of different, yeah. So, but having said that, there are also like high-end Linux apps that people are using
right.
that like Smoke and Flame and Flint, all these Autodesk applications that, like I say, they're bound to like these huge workstations that you can't get for less than $100,000.
You should talk to Alan. Alan does IC layout, and there's an application that he uses that's like $60,000-$70,000.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's all he does, and it's a very specific thing.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
You know, he's designing chips for like cell phones and embedded devices.
That's really cool.
You know, but it's a proprietary thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's the standard application.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
Use.
There's no way around it.
So let me ask you, where would you like to see the whole video thing going on Linux?
I honestly, man, I really think that it needs to go to Linux. It, like, video editing needs to shift to Linux. Like, that would be the ideal. Because I'm telling you, when I was using Final Cut, as great of a flexible program, I shouldn't even use the word flexible, as a robust program it is completely inflexible. You know, they have their own set of priorities, their own things that they're going to let you do. And that's it. That's as far as you're
going to go. I know where you're going with
yeah,
this. If
so
there's
there
an open source application that the industry can get behind, they will pay developers to develop for that program to
yeah.
implement the things that they want implemented.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know?
And that's where it's going to. That's where it should go, because there's nothing more frustrating for an editor who's supposed to be an artist.
Right.
You know?
They shouldn't worry about the
They shouldn't
rules.
Have to worry about
it's,
that
it's
stuff.
It's supposed to enable them to be
yeah.
able to do what they
yeah.
want to do, and that's to create video, TV shows, movies, film, you know.
In a stylistic way that's entertaining.
Exactly.
You know? And the current proprietary software is not letting them do that.
I know, like, the whole thing is where if you buy a proprietary product like that, you'll have users who are using it, and they want certain feature sets implemented.
Right.
And it's like throwing a bottle over a wall, and
yeah.
there's maybe a 1 in 10 chance or 1
yeah.
in 5, 10 chance, you know, whatever. That they'll actually implement what you want implemented.
Correct. Yeah. No, that's very true. I have filed, when I was teaching people, you know, the programs, I would file, not bug report. Well, I would file bug reports too, but feature requests. And I would never hear back from the, you know, I mean, you know, these companies don't talk to you. It's not a conversation, you know. You get to suggest something, you pitch it, and maybe it shows up, maybe it doesn't.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Linux, I think, would be the way to go for video editing.
Now, one of the big things now is doing web.
Yeah.
What are some of the challenges of doing web video? Obviously, we have to make it a smaller resolution, not a high bit rate when you do the
exactly.
encoding.
Correct. Yep. Frame size and bit rate are the two biggest variables there, and so like if you drop frame rate, you're dropping smoothness of picture.
Well, let me ask you, at what point, when the frame rate drops, is it discernible by the eye, do you know?
That's a good question. It's probably
some people probably have
exactly
on your eye
yeah.
and how trained you are to it to notice it.
Exactly, yeah. Sense. And it depends on the action, you know, like if it's a slow, smooth pan.
Right, if it's like, if there's a video of me and you talking to each other, you don't need a super
you don't
high
need
bit
any,
rate.
Yeah, you know, big deal.
Right.
But yeah, if it's a lot of moving camera, then you tend to notice it quicker when it's not being smooth. And another, you know what, another obstacle for web video is how reliant everyone right now is on Flash.
Flash, yep.
It's the worst codec in the world.
No, let's,
it was never
this,
designed.
This is a whole other can of worms.
Okay.
Here. Let's talk about this for a couple minutes.
Okay, now. I will.
Okay, we talk about multimedia codecs on the web.
Yeah.
Okay? Flash is a quote-unquote industry standard.
Right.
Okay, but it's still controlled by one company.
Correct.
Okay. we have problems with that.
Yeah.
You know, people saying, oh, Adobe's going to open source it, blah, 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 blah. It's not going to happen.
Not going to happen.
They're never going to open source
it. No, it's not going to happen.
You know, what is the hope? Is it Dirac? You know, Dirac, you know, seems to be...
It's going
to
be... Yeah.
I've looked at some of those sample videos.
Yes.
And it looks pretty high quality stuff.
It's very high quality.
Nice,
it's really
nice. High definition,
nice.
Smooth.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that... I mean, especially since Dirac is being developed for video, whereas Flash from the beginning was developed for animation.
Animation, right. Little website animation.
A little bit of a difference there.
Yes.
So it's basically turning your, you know, your video into a bitmap image that it's now, you know, instead of doing what it was supposed to be doing, which is moving vector shapes around, which I think the open source version of that is SVG.
Right.
That's what I've heard. It's going to go into like more of an animation entity, almost like an animated GIF except for vectors. But yeah, so the Dirac I think would be great, and it's non, you know, it's not, or you know what, Xvid is good too. I like
Xvid
a lot
too.
Yeah,
like,
so.
Like on my MythBox, if I have like shows I want to archive,
yeah,
I'll take like an MPEG-2 file, you know, standard definition.
Yep.
And I'll re-encode it to a low bitrate doing an Xvid.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's the quality
it's
is
actually
good,
really nice.
And the size of the files are fairly small.
Yeah, yeah. And it's got, you know, Xvid is picking up support. I mean, they're actually, I don't know how they're doing it, but I mean, you'll see, I've seen a video camera that shoots Xvid, you know, it's like some weird little, you know, company you've never heard of, but
right.
I mean, you know, the fact that it is an option out there.
Xvid is basically DivX, an open implementation.
Exactly, exactly,
DivX.
Correct. And DivX was from the beginning a competitor of MPEG-2,
right?
Which is cool because, I mean, there you go, right away, it's not controlled by just one entity, you know?
Right. Well, let me get your take on, like, high-definition video.
Oh, man. I mean, high-def, I don't actually love it that much.
You think it's a big hype to certain
I do. Thing? I really do. What it is, I think, is it's a substitute for the how much information you can pack into a film image, which is a lot
right.
more than you'll ever be
oh,
able
yeah.
to pack
so,
into
say,
digital.
Say a film on a
yeah.
big screen. What's
oh,
the
man.
Resolution on that? Do you know?
It's phenomenal. It's not. It's. I mean, supposedly it's not even achievable by digital. I mean, it's just there's so. I mean, just the grain and everything like that. You just can't. You can't get that much activity on a screen on digital without just killing the system.
Right.
So you know, I mean. In theory, film is the great thing that you're never going to be able to achieve on digital. And I know everyone's said that about digital before, but I believe it. I think that maybe some sort of hybrid, like a digital analog film or something like that. But I just don't think that high def is ever going to look like film. And I think they're just packing more and more pixels into it and saying, see how sharp it is? It's just like film. And it's like, no, it's not like film because film is about the depth of the picture, not the necessarily the clarity of it.
This almost as parallels what happened with audio.
It exactly
you know,
compares
a lot
to
of
that.
Audio engineers, when there was this whole move towards digital.
Everyone wanted to switch
they
over
said,
to it.
We want a tube amp, okay, that has its own feel and
yeah.
sound to it.
Yeah.
We want tape. And we want records. Like, if
yes.
you play a record, it's going to have a certain sound.
Totally
to it.
Different, yeah.
And dynamic that you don't get with digital. I mean, the
yeah.
digital is cleaner. I mean, we talk about, like, you know, like MP3s, you know, the digital generation.
Right.
A lot of those people really don't have a clue of what high-quality audio truly sounds like.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
The only thing that, like, you know, short of a WAV file
yeah.
is maybe FLAC because it's a
yeah.
lossless codec.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of these people, they, you know, they're used to hearing shitty sounding audio.
It's amazing. I know, because I mean, people will not, they won't hear the difference between an MP3 and like a WAV file.
Right.
They just don't hear it. They don't pick it up.
Not tuned
yeah,
to it.
Yeah. And you're just like, are you serious? You know, because if you go back and listen to the album, I mean, it's like it sounds totally different. So
yeah.
you know, yeah.
So I guess it's almost the same kind of argument then, that if you have a trained eye looking at high definition video, you'll see, you know, the high res. I guess one of the nice side effects though of HD is that, you know, we're getting rid of PAL and NTSC.
Yes, and that is
and
great.
That has been a horrible division.
It's been
that
terrible.
Has gone on for way too long.
Plus the whole pixel aspect ratio, because HD is finally just square pixels. Before that, it's been rectangle pixels for video, or rectangle for Photoshop and no, square for Photoshop, rectangle for video, and you've always had to like adjust your aspect ratio and stuff like
so
that.
So in that respect, you know, standardization is a good thing.
I think it's
and
great.
And it's a global
yeah.
standardization.
Yeah, exactly. So
you know, the only thing that's different is how they actually transmit
the delivery,
the data,
yeah,
the
exactly.
delivery mechanism.
Yeah, which they just don't want
to. I know
to,
in Europe they use DVB.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No, right. Over here it's a little bit different.
Okay, yeah.
It's not the same.
Yeah.
But it's still the same video. Video is a video.
Yeah. I mean, I'm hoping that, like, I don't know, I play some synthesizers, and, like, back when they were switching from, like, analog to the digital stuff, you know, a lot of the, like, and that's why the 80s music, like, that synth pop stuff
sounds
like that.
You like those old analog synths.
I like the old analog ones. But what they've done recently, especially, like, Roland and you know, the big names, they do, like, hybrids of, like, the analog model, but they're emulating the analog stuff digitally. So you're getting
I know what you mean. They'll have, like, digital representations of those old analog. They'll have, like, a Moog sound card or an old Roland sound card.
Yeah, but you have to still build them the way you would with analog.
You've got to start with, like, a waveform and tweak it.
Yeah. So if something like that could happen, again, I'm not a programmer. I don't know enough about these algorithms to know, to talk officially, intelligently about it. But if something like that could happen, I think that'd be pretty cool.
One really thing I wanted to ask you about is someone who's fairly knowledgeable about video editing and the whole process. What do you use to build your final files, different resolution, different format files? Are you strictly an FFmpeg person with command line?
I actually do a lot of FFmpeg. I've been trying to use Mincoder more. I don't know why, but I'm just used to FFmpeg. So,
as far as like the final result of the file, the quality of it, they're pretty comparable, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I honestly don't see any difference between the two. So, I learned FFmpeg on the Mac when I was still doing
FFmpeg is used by a lot of people.
Oh man, it's everywhere. It's everywhere, and it's so good.
I know. It really is a Swiss Army knife.
Yeah, it is. Again, when I was using Final Cut or teaching people Final Cut, there would be things that, again, Final Cut couldn't do, and I would have to break out FFmpeg in order to achieve it, you know? And it was just, it's so obvious that open source is the answer, because when you need that Swiss Army knife, it's the open source people who give it to you.
All right, I have one final question for you.
Cool.
As someone who used to be a hardcore Apple person doing a lot of Apple stuff, you've come over to the other side, to the Linux camp.
I have.
Do you get a lot of hate mail, and do people bust your chops about it, bust your balls about it?
You know, actually, I haven't gotten that much hate mail. Most people are pretty into what I'm saying, I think, because I think maybe they get some kind of impression that that I know what I'm talking about, maybe. But no, I mean,
but you've worked in the industry; you're fairly knowledgeable.
Exactly.
About how it works.
So I'm not just like hating Mac.
You're not just some guy who happens to run Linux and has gotten the video.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, I am a fanboy. I think I'm a Linux fanboy at this point, but realistically, I'm also not. I'm actually comparing my experience from having worked on the Mac with what I'm experiencing on Linux, and I'm just giving the honest difference, the opinion of what's different. So,
do you only have Apple hardware, or have you branched out to different?
I've totally bridged out. I got my Triple E with me. I've got a Sony.
You're
so
into the Nokia too, right?
I got my Nokia, which is like
awesome device. Man.
Yeah, man. I mean, yeah, no, it's. I think the generic hardware is kind of the way to go, just for compatibility, price, lots of different things. So
awesome, man. I really dig your show, man. I think you're really doing a great service.
Yeah, well, you guys are
doing
great. I enjoyed
coming on your show, and I appreciate you coming on
your
show.
Yeah, yeah, no, I appreciated it.
I think you're really doing a great thing for the community. And
I'm established now because I'm on Tilts. This is like, now I'm real. I'm here. All right, cool. Thanks for having me on.
Anytime, man. Take care.
Yeah, cool. Okay.
All right, we got Ken Van Dyne from the Foresight Linux Project, and the big man here can sit in the chair. How you doing, Ken? It's good to see you, man.
You want me to sit on your knee, Jono?
I always want you to sit on me.
Okay. What is the better distro right now, Foresight Linux or Ubuntu?
Foresight, of course.
Sorry. Involuntary reaction.
And we got Jono Bacon here from Ubuntu Project. How are you, Jono? Canonical.
No, I have nothing but love for Ubuntu.
We have nothing but love for Foresight.
I just wouldn't use it.
Ditto.
So what's going on with Foresight, man? What's hot and happening in Foresight? I know Foresight has always been like, you guys want to run the latest and greatest GNOME.
Yeah. We're not just really about the latest and greatest GNOME anymore. It's really about the latest and greatest in desktop innovation. I mean, the desktop is evolving very, very rapidly, and our goal is really to push out this innovation incrementally so people get to see new features, better hardware support very quickly. And we're also now spending a lot of time working on some other distros that are consume Foresight. So, for example, we have the Kids Edition, which have a number of games and edutainment kind of stuff, which I've loved seeing some kids playing with it today here at the show. It's been awesome.
You got a couple small kids, right?
Yeah, I do. I have three.
And obviously they're using it.
One of them is the six-year-old. The other ones are a little too little for it so far, but they will all use it, of course.
The other ones are using Ubuntu.
And we also have the mobile edition, which I have to give props to Ubuntu for that, because a lot of the work that we've integrated into the mobile edition was actually developed by a Canonical employee. So Neil rocks.
Neil does rock. Yeah, he's a good guy.
The netbook remix stuff is great. We've integrated all that stuff. We created the mobile edition, which is really focused on it's really optimized for small screens. So the idea is you get the most out of your real estate.
Now, you guys have started selling boxes with Foresight preloaded on them, right?
We're not selling them. We have vendors that are selling them. Yes.
Right. Those little shuttle boxes, right?
The little shuttle boxes we have over that we're showing off. They have several. They have two different KPC lines right now, and they have the X2700, which is kind of the size of a Mac Mini that they're selling. And the X2700 is actually Foresight exclusive. No Windows available on it at all.
Let me ask you. When I first tried Foresight going back maybe a year and change ago, it seemed that the only real big limitation at the time was the lack of packages. You didn't guys have a ton of packages. Not as much as, say, Ubuntu or Debian. In those worlds, how's that going as far as ramping up people contributing packages?
I think we have somewhere in the order of close to 4,000 packages.
That's pretty good.
Repository. That's nothing compared to the total count that you'll get out of the Debian-based repositories. But the Debian-based repositories, a lot of those packages aren't maintained anymore, so I don't have a really good count of what that number is. But frankly, most of the common applications that people really care about is available.
Cool, cool. John's got to leave in a few minutes, so let's talk to him for a little bit here.
Yeah.
What's going on with IBEX? It's coming out very shortly, man.
Yeah, man. It comes out in a couple of weeks.
Yeah?
We released the beta about a week ago, something like that. And it's doing well. I mean, there's been some bugs, which is why we do a beta release. And the pace of bug reporting, the pace of bug triaging, the pace of bug fixing has been really good. So I'm really happy with things. So it's all ticking over nicely.
Yeah. One of the things, talking to both of you guys, is the whole ultra-mobile machine. It's just going gangbusters right now, man. And to put it bluntly, it's fucking awesome.
Yeah, no doubt.
We had a bunch of our friends and different podcasters, guys, were up in the room. Everybody had like a different, ultra-mobile machine. We laid them out in the bed. We were booting them up and checking out the speed differences and the interfaces. It was basically geek porn going on. We had a little photo session going on.
It's pretty stunning. I mean, it's just the way the industry is going is interesting. I think the way free software is branching out in so many different ways, and there's room for everyone,
Right. And it's a great opportunity for Linux, because you can really do a lot more with Linux on that platform than you can with other operating systems. I would hate to say the name, but you really can't optimize that for a small screen.
Right? I know. I was watching. I got up this morning. I put the TV on. It's QVC, which is like one of those home shopping kind of things. And they were showing Acer Aspire 1s with Windows XP. And you know how much they were selling them for? For $600 with a $100 rebate. Meanwhile, these guys here, they got one with the Linux version. They paid $325 for it.
Right. Yeah.
And the thing is so much faster, and it's so much quicker and snappier, and it's just a better experience than anything. Why the hell would you want to run a 7-8-year-old operating system especially a smaller scale machine? It doesn't make sense.
Right. We've got a couple of the Intel classmates over on our table. I don't think a whole lot of people have seen the classmates yet, but they're getting a lot of press lately. They're turning up in several countries as giveaways to students, young children in large quantities. And they're all going to be powered by Linux.
That's awesome.
And we got a couple of them over our booth. Joe, if you want to
Check them out
later, you can.
Back to Ubuntu, John. What are some of the new features that we're going to notice in IBEX? What's the hot thing?
So I mean, we've been fixing chunks of X, and the X is a lot more stable than it used to be. Things like bulletproof X.
What about Pulse Audio? I know a lot of people bitch about Pulse Audio.
Yeah,
Pulse Audio is awesome.
We had a few bumps in Hardy with Pulse Audio, and those have been straightened out. I mean, we got some cool little things. We got a user presence applet that's now shipping by default, which we've developed and thrown upstream, and we've got things like the guest user thing. Like the amount of time somebody will say, "Hey, can I use your computer for 5 minutes?" And people freak out for that reason, for many reasons, right? Some people freak out because they just don't like people touching their computer. Some people freak out because they don't want someone to type something like a couple of letters into Firefox, and then the history drops down and they see all the porn that they've been viewing. There's various reasons why people, and this just creates just an empty session and destroys it afterwards.
It's TempFS or something, right?
Yeah, it's pretty funky, and we're shipping obviously latest GNOME and there's a bunch of other stuff.
Network Manager 0.77 is fantastic.
Yeah,
it's a great improvement. Yeah. I got to run it on this machine here, It has 3G card support in it now, and it really is fully functional.
The mobile broadband stuff is really starting to rock, and this is a primary goal that we've been setting ourselves, like, you know, getting all of these 3G cards working and things like that, like you guys have got working. So
well, one of the things that like bugged me about Network Manager is it seemed that it was only a specific set of hardware that it worked well with, and a lot of people would have to go to something, say, like Wicked, okay, which is a great project in its own right.
Yeah, yeah.
It's completely Python based, but the new release of Network Manager really, I think it's made a big step forward.
I wish they would have a 0.7 release. We've still been waiting for it. SVN snapshots is all we can use. So.
Right. I've been pulling down off of Launchpad.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Those are SVN snapshots. They're going to have a release within the next couple of weeks before Fedora 10 is released.
Right.
There'll be a real 0.7 release. But unfortunately, we're not consuming that yet, but we're consuming something pretty darn close to it.
Yeah.
What else? What else we got?
Well, I mean, the thing is...
Jonah, do you have any statistics on bugs that you guys have closed for Intrepid?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't got the specific on hand, but like, so we've had a lot of focus in this cycle on bugs. We released the something called the Upstream Report the other, you know, a couple of weeks back, and basically the plan behind the Upstream Report is for us to say what are the most problematic projects in Ubuntu in terms of bugs. So, for example, you know, there's a certain number of open bugs, and then if a bug is likely to be a bug upstream, then you can set an upstream task on that. But then, one of the cool features in Launchpad is the fact that you can link a bug in Ubuntu and a bug to upstream. So, like, status changes and things like that are reflected. So, the upstream report was basically a project to try and identify the projects that need the most work. This is what George Castro has been working on. And you know, when we combine that with something like five a day, I mean, we you know, where people do five
a day. I saw that. You guys were pushing to get, you know, bug reporting.
It's been a great initiative. I'm very impressed.
Yeah, five a day has been... I'm really proud of what we've managed to achieve with that. And we've touched, you know... I can't remember exactly, but it's something like 18,000 bugs since February. So it's pretty fun.
Very impressive.
Yeah, it's cool.
Upstream contributions is a big issue now. You know, a lot of people are making light that, you know, not enough upstream, you know, fixes go up.
So yeah, this has been something which we get some flack about. So
a little bit.
Let me explain the policy that we have essentially.
Okay.
So basically, some people believe that that Canonical has a policy that we don't allow upstream development. That's bullshit. Our policy has generally been we identify a roadmap for Ubuntu, and then we encourage our employees to write any upstream software that's relevant to that roadmap. So if we're wanting to make, let's say we're trying to improve, you know, mobile networking support in Ubuntu, and something's missing, then we'll encourage our employees fix it and send it upstream. What we don't do, that, for example, Nivelle and Red Hat do, is we don't just do generic upstream development. We don't just say, you know, oh, we're just going to let someone loose and just develop whatever they need.
Right, they write an application, and if somebody happens to use it, great.
And the simple reason for that is that we're a small company. I mean...
How many employees are in Canonical now?
About 205, 206.
That's small. That's tiny.
I mean, Nivelle have got thousands of employees. Red Hat have got thousands of employees. You know, Greg KH gave us quite a considerable amount of shit about our kernel contributions. And... The way I like to read the situation, I mean, if we suck at upstream stuff, then I want to know that so I can help fix that, right?
Exactly. There's an issue in addressing it.
Yeah, and I think Greg KH was a bit unfair in the fact that, you know, I believe that you can only contribute a certain amount of upstream work based upon the size of your workforce, you know. And I think we do a reasonable amount for the size of the company. We're still a small company, but just because, like, you know, the guy who founded the company is a millionaire doesn't mean we have unlimited
resources. Yeah,
and we have to be frugal at times. Yeah. But it's something that's going to be changed. Like, we're doing a lot of new upstream development work with GNOME, some of the desktop experience stuff that's going to be going up there. And you know, I'm really keen to make sure that we are, you know, we're fair citizens in the community. And if people think that we're not fair citizens, then I'd like to hear specifics, you know. And
exactly.
Really, here's my perception of the thing. I think maybe you guys haven't committed a ton of code upstream, but you guys have done a lot more than just code. You've done a lot for the Linux name, the Linux desktop.
Right.
There's a lot of things you've brought to this community.
You brought Mindshare.
That other distros haven't brought.
Right.
And so people aren't seeing that. They're seeing codes, number lines of code, commits, number of commits.
Yeah.
And a lot of that's bogus data anyway, because people don't necessarily commit using their canonical.com email address, and forcing them to do that's dumb.
Yeah. Right?
So and other companies have the same problem. Right. That's a bad criteria. you guys have done a lot of good stuff.
It's also, yeah, I mean, I think that it's... I think it's always important to try and be fair and... You know, if we suck, we suck. You know, we need to fix it. But I mean, a good example. I mean, credit is never fairly distributed anywhere. You know,
people only like to bitch, man. That's the thing. You guys know when you were doing Lug Radio.
Yeah.
You know, you get positive feedback, but there's a ton of negative feedback. People just love to complain about things.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's
human
like,
nature.
It's like the you know, the big SSL debacle that happened with Debian and everything. Like there was a number of Ubuntu developers who actually highlighted and contributed and helped resolve that problem, but we never got any credit. And there was very little credit towards that. And, you know, that happens, you know. I mean, it doesn't surprise me to a degree because Ubuntu's had a pretty surprising level of success, I think. I mean, even before I joined Canonical, I was amazed at how the Ubuntu train was, like, rocking. And I think that when people see people successful, there's a human inclination to bitch,
sure,
to try and find flaws.
Exactly.
And, you know, and try and level people, you know. So I don't blame people for having these perspectives, but my primary concern is not to listen to the trolling. My primary concern is to, if we do suck, we need to fix it. Yay!
There you go.
Getting attacked over here.
So if someone has
look at the big picture.
Someone has a real little legitimate gripe, you guys want to hear about it,
send me an email.
Exactly.
People have got a legitimate gripe and you can point to something instead of just like opinion, then
okay. Well, one of the other things that Ubuntu's pushing big time now is on the server, it seems.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing we're really proud of recently is Wikipedia.
They've migrated over.
Migrated to a... Well, I don't know if it's happened yet, but they're migrating to Ubuntu server. They made the decision. That's 400 servers.
That's a huge deal.
Like, I have quite a serious Wikipedia addiction problem. I just can't get enough of that thing. And
admitting is the first step.
Well, the thing is, Wikipedia to me is a bit like, it's a bit like kind of, I'm just reading IRC.
We're looking at DRC and Heaven's Revenge is going total nuts on John. I'm bitching about Canonical. That's the thing when you do a live show like this and you get the IRC going, it's like a teleprompter, it's distracting.
Right.
But it's good to a certain degree, you know, there's pluses and minuses.
All right, then, I'll tell you what, Heaven's Revenge, send me an email and give me some details, right, instead of just bullshitting on IRC, right? And then let's talk about it in more detail.
There you go.
What were we talking about?
Wikipedia and your addiction.
Yeah, it's like...
your porn addiction?
Yeah, I have quite a serious problem with Wikipedia. I'm posing for a... Yeah. Man,
no distractions here.
That was vaguely erotic.
That's what Dan keeps saying.
No, it's cool. There's
enough to go around. We can share.
The server thing's going well, and I'm happy with where we're going.
That's a tough place to get into, because there's a lot of vendors that have been there for a long time and are really entrenched.
I think so, yeah. And I think, you know, sysadmins are a difficult breed to persuade because part of being a sysadmin is being conservative and, like, knowing what you know and making sure it runs and ticks. And, you know, if someone who's got experience in the desktop comes in and says, hey, we can do the server thing as well, I can understand why some sysadmins
are suspicious. Are you guys going to do any certification strictly for the server, like an admin type thing?
I'm not sure. I'd imagine so.
I would imagine so, too. I mean,
our training, the training side of things is really ramping up there. You know, that side of things, the business is really doing well, but we'll see. I'm not
the biggest part of Red Hat's business.
Yeah,
yeah.
Red Hat have like built
Sun,
like a,
Sun is big. I work in IT in the financial industry, brokerage, banking, and a lot of the places are real hardcore Sun Solaris places. Now they're starting to get into Linux on a server, and it seems it's almost exclusively Red Hat, which is understandably so because that's been their core business for quite some time now.
Yep.
So
it's all good.
Excellent, man. Thanks for stopping by and seeing
me. No, thanks for you guys. It's great to finally meet you.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I'm sorry we couldn't get out to Wolverhampton for Lug Radio Live.
Nah, it's fine.
It's a little tough, man, when you got family.
It's a long way. Believe me, if you're going to go to England, don't go to Wolverhampton. All right.
Are you moving?
No.
Did you grow up in Wolverhampton?
No, I moved there to go to university.
Okay.
And
you stayed.
Yeah. And the walls are too big to navigate over, so it's all
awesome,
good.
Man.
Cool.
Good to talk to you.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Oh, you want to stay and talk about a little bit more Foresight, Ken? I just got the John up because he had a run.
I can talk a little bit. Actually, I have a little bit of Ubuntu stuff I can talk about.
Hey,
when
do you switch mics to the better mic?
We have my day job at RPath. We actually have an R Builder Online, the tool we use for building software appliances.
Great stuff, man.
Yeah, we have Ubuntu Hardy official bits imported into R Builder, so you can create appliances built on Ubuntu now using RPath tools, which is pretty cool.
Right. Like I know with RPath, that's like a big thing, doing the whole appliance thing, building
right.
something specific. What are some of the things that are happening with RPath?
Well, look, so one of the big things, now we've added Ubuntu there, so you can actually build your appliance with Ubuntu, which is pretty nice. I don't know how many people are actually using that yet. I'm built first sample appliance to kind of show it off. It's a basically a lamp-based stack, which I built the original lamp appliance on our builder online years ago, which has been maintained by somebody else now. But it's basically, you know, the entire stack you can download, drop your web application on it, load your database, and tweak it by hand if you want to replace a normal server. So I've done the same thing now for WAMP, which is UAMP, Ubuntu, instead of Linux. I just renamed it.
That's a good thing.
But it's based on the Ubuntu platform, so it kind of shows off the abilities to create a software appliance out of the Ubuntu bits. And these are actually, we're not rebuilding Ubuntu sources, we're actually importing their binaries. And we're actually working with those guys on that, which has been cool. Some of the other cool stuff we've been doing, we've got something called the Appliance Creator now on our Builder Online. So you can go on our Builder and create a product on our Builder, and you can upload an RPM, a deb package, the binaries, actual binaries, or a binary tarball of an application, and give it a directory to extract it in and create a bootable appliance out the other end. Just through a web-based GUI, not having to use any command line
stuff. Here's a dumb question for you, and you'll have to excuse me because I haven't used RPath yet. Even though I looked at it a long time ago, I really don't remember.
I forgive you.
How smart is the RPath appliance creation? Like, if I have, just a stupid web application, and I want to create an appliance that'll run that, do I also get a really full base distribution underneath it without having to specify everything individually?
It's what we call juice. Some of the people have kind of taken on to that term as well, but we originally coined that a few years ago, just enough operating system. Okay. The idea is we have very, very rich, fine-grained dependencies, and packages actually get broken up into separate components. So, for example, MySQL. MySQL has a runtime component, a lib component, a devel component, a devel lib component, doc component. It's all broke down, so the documentation is in a separate component.
Right.
And then those dependencies are at the file level, and whatever component provides that file is what you get. So if your application needs to talk to a MySQL database, but it doesn't need to actually have the user bin MySQL client, you know, it all it brings in is the libraries, MySQL
like
lib.
You wouldn't have to specify, you know, that you want a networking type of thing.
No, so,
you know?
So some stuff you get kind of for free with the appliance platform stuff, which are things that can't be discovered via dependencies that you need to have a bootable system, right?
Okay.
So we have some stuff that's kind of predefined that you don't really need to worry about.
Like, and it's a very base network system.
Yeah, and it's a very small subset. It doesn't even have SSH.
Okay.
You don't, because most appliances don't need SSH, right? That's the idea. You can add it if you need to, but you don't really need it if you don't have to. So if your application links against MySQL, Canary will discover that dependency, and it'll say, I just need the libraries for MySQL, and only install the library.
Right.
So then if somebody actually did get a command line on the box, they can't type the MySQL command line and run it, because they don't need it. It's an appliance.
Right.
That's really our vision, right? Mm-hmm. However, if you want to add the entire package so you get the whole client and you only get the server and all that stuff, you can do that as well, if that's important to you. But our idea is to be as small as possible, just giving you just the pieces you need to make your application work is really what the goal is. Not to make a full server, is to make your application work.
Well, one of the things when I looked at Foresight, and Canary in particular, was how easy and straightforward it was to create a package. Very, very straightforward and not very difficult at all.
Yeah, it's quite easy to build stuff from sources. It's gotten a lot better now. We've got some concepts of factories, which is a little bit technical, but the ideas behind these factories is they live under the covers for what we call the appliance creator, where you can literally take packages in a web interface and take an RPM from, say, CentOS, and drop it into a web form, click a little button, it processes for a couple seconds and gives you all the metadata that's in that RPM, of the package name, the version, the license, the description that it reads out of the RPM, and you can edit it if you want, and then you hit submit, and it does a little build process. It doesn't actually have to recompile it, but it imports those binaries into Canary, into a repository that again can be included in your appliance. So you can take binaries from other distributions and create appliances out of those and get the same benefits you get out of using RPath stuff. And now you can actually do that as well with the Ubuntu platform, and soon there'll be other platforms as well.
Right. The whole thing with package management is that all the different Linux distributions have their own system for the most part. There's different, you know, groupings of it. You know, the Debian base have apt-get.
Right.
You know, you've got RPM and SUSE and Mandriva, you know. Do we need to be on one package management system?
In a utopia, yes. It'll never happen, unfortunately. There's many reasons why I think Canary is superior to the others. Everybody has their own opinions on that kind of thing.
Rollback is an incredible feature.
Rollback is huge. Sane updates. I think I explained this last time we talked, but I mean, what happens right now if you're on an Ubuntu system and you're updating your system and you pull the network cable while it's in the middle of writing a file out to your disk? You have a shared library in your system that's half written out to disk, and now you have a CREP library on your box.
Right.
Using Canary, if you did that same exact thing, Canary reverts the last portion of that job. It breaks down the big update into smaller jobs. It reverts that job and the file system changes automatically for you. So the next time you plug that cable in and you rerun the update, it just picks up where it left off, and your system is completely sane. It's completely dependency closed, and there's no CREP files.
So how does it handle the dependencies, like if you imported an RPM, specific RPM that you wanted, doesn't have its dependencies met?
If it doesn't have the dependencies met, that's the problem. It'll fail to build the appliance. It'll say, I can't satisfy this dependency. But we can see that we have that dependency, even if we don't have that package already, because it inspects the libraries. It actually goes in.
So while it's incorporating that RPM, it will inspect it and say that you have a dependency that isn't
right.
met?
It'll create it won't tell you that the dependency is not met in creating the package. It'll actually work, and it encodes all the requires information that it needs in that package when it commits it to the repository. The place where you'll see a failure is when you try to build that into an appliance. It'll try to build an appliance, and it'll say, this soname isn't met somewhere, this dependency for a soname. I can't find that. Right. And it'll complain and it will fail to build the appliance because that application is not going to work for you. Unfortunately, there's no way at package creation time to discover that because you might be packaging that other dependency as well
sure.
in another job. If you do all that stuff from the command line, you can actually do it all in one job. But using the web interface, you do one package at a time.
So back to Foresight for a minute here. What are some of the things that you're looking to incorporate going forward?
Going forward, probably the next... So we've been spending a lot of time working on these. Original plan when we went to Foresight 2 was to turn it more into a desktop platform that other people could build on. And we've been spending more time actually doing that lately, where we designed it to be a platform when we created it. We've only had the Foresight desktop consuming that platform so far. But with the work we've been doing with the guys from Shuttle, which we love Shuttle, they've been amazing to us. They donate a lot of stuff to us. They sponsor, you know, our marketing guy who usually pays to travel himself to these shows to go places. It's been great. These guys, they actually have a marketing guy who is maintaining derivative distributions on Foresight right now. Non-technical marketing guy. He's a hardware guy. He's been selling hardware. And the idea was, you know, we take Foresight and make it very, very simple to say, I want to derive Foresight and I want to make these few changes. You don't even have to rebuild most of the packages from source that you want to change, because Canary has the ability to grab the upstream package and replace individual files without rebuilding the binary. For you. So, the guy we work with at Shuttle, you know, he's a marketing guy. He's a smart guy. Love him to death, Nick. He goes out with this rbuild tool, and he does an rbuild checkout, you know, libgnome. And it checks out GNOME, but what it does is it creates a derivative of the package that we maintain in Foresight that he can then say, with a single line, I want to add this file to the package. And what it does is it replaces the file that we ship. So, like, say, for example, the gconf schema file that maintains all the information about all the default themes. He can just replace that one file in it. And when he runs the build process on that, very simple command, rbuild build packages, builds all your packages you're working on. It actually rebuilds that package with his change in it, without actually compiling the source code. It just injects his change into it. And then he maintains the distro that way. And he's got Shuttle's using Foresight machines internally in their corporate offices. So they're replacing Windows with Foresight. And what they've done is, instead of taking a default Foresight and installing it on machines and then installing software, configuring stuff, and removing software, they've created their own custom corporate edition that they use internally that has Skype included, because they talk to their Taiwan office with Skype, the Likewise Open, which is how they connect to the Active Directory and get all the stuff they need to from Active Directory. They actually log into their GNOME desktop with their Active Directory accounts using Likewise Open. They remove some stuff that they don't particularly care about having in their corporate environment. They add a few other things that they care about. So they manage it at that level, and then they get ISOs out of the other end that they can do network installs in the office that don't need tweaking at all when they come up. They boot up and a user can log into it and start using it. And then if they need to add packages, they add it to the distro, and they do go through this quick build process, and it takes a few minutes, and next updates on these machines, they get the new applications. And it's a great way to use it. And that's how we've been building the mobile edition, the kids edition, soon-to-be Media Center edition featuring Elisa Media Center.
Cool.
We're going to have one of those soon once I work out all the kinks of making remotes just work without configuring them. That's hard.
We got a question here in the RC.
Sure.
EE Ping Jockey wants to know, what language is Canary coded in?
Mostly Python and a little piece, as little as possible in C. But places where we can get some real performance improvements have been written in C. And just a few weeks ago, we rewrote more of it in C, just to make some other processes, dependency calculations, faster.
What about like the netbooks and stuff like that? Are you guys pursuing working on any netbook type?
Yeah, so you missed the beginning of the conversation. Yes, we have the Foresight Mobile Edition now, which is actually featuring the netbook remix stuff that Canonical did. Great work by those guys. But it's really optimized for the small screens. Mm-hmm. We have a couple of them over in our booth if you want to go play with them, Intel Classmates. Really great platform. When I created it on a EEE 701. Figured it was the lowest common denominator. It has the smallest screen, the smallest solid-state disk of all of them. So the idea was to make it fit on that and work well on 800 by 400, and it works.
Awesome.
So if you want to play with it, go buy our
booth. When can I expect to see one for my Acer Aspire 1?
It works on the Aspire 1. Yeah. We have users using it on Aspire 1.
Check it out, man.
I'm all over that.
We're not targeting a specific platform with it. We're trying to make it work
like
with as many netbooks as possible.
Like a bum on a bologna sandwich, man. I'm going to be all over that one.
We've got users using on the 701, the 901, the Acer Aspire, the MSI Wind, the HP 2133. I don't think I've had any reports from anybody on the Dell Mini yet. And the Intel Classmates, which we have over in our booth, for sure.
We'll have to compare that one to the Acer. Right now,
yeah, I'm going to have to go take a look.
We've been doing speed tests with the different
minis. What did you think of the Aspire 1?
He's got one.
I love it. It's awesome.
How speedy is it?
Very, very fast.
Okay. So one of our main, lead developers on Foresight, he bought one, but he returned it because the I/O speeds were really bad.
Really?
And he had used the EEE, and the EEE was faster.
The I/O speeds are relative because it depends on your SD media.
Absolutely. Well, I'm talking about the integrated, what's built in.
I don't have a problem with the I/O speeds on
there. It might have been he just had a bum model or something.
Defective,
but he returned it because the I/O speeds. I haven't been very happy with the speeds on the EEE as well. These classmates that we have,
EEE, the 701, 709,
the 701,
yeah, they're a little bit slow compared to the
Intel classmates we have. Actually, have real hard drives in them, 30 gig drives, and it's great. I mean, it's as fast as using a desktop,
right?
And it's the Atom based 1.6 gig. Processor.
Yeah, that's what the Acer Aspire 1 is.
It's very speedy.
Chad, before he works for Asus, he has the EEPC,
the
1000.
That's really nice. Sweet, too. Yeah.
I'd like to have one for a test box if somebody wants to send it to me.
If I see him, I'll grab him and I'll bring him over too, so you can check it out.
Cool. I've used the 901, which is a bit better. My biggest complaint with the Asus is that the keyboard's too small.
Right. The new one has a full-size keyboard. It's very
a bigger keyboard?
Much bigger.
Bigger? Okay. That's good. So I think even all the way up through the 901.
It's very close.
Right. I think the 701 through the 901 had the same size keyboard. You just more effectively used the screen size.
Right.
But the 1000 is a little bit bigger. I think the 1000 is the same size as the Intel Classmate. The Intel Classmate is really cool, too, because it's very rugged. It's designed for kids and actually has a carry handle. It's got a water-resistant keyboard. It's kind of built tough. You know, it's got the Rubbermaid kind of feel cover on it.
Right.
And it's got big rubber feet on the bottom of it, and you can really bounce it around. It's very, very rugged feeling, and I really like it.
Is it, like, usable for a computer geeky kind of guy?
I wouldn't use it. I fit in that category. I wouldn't use it all day.
Right.
But I certainly love carrying it around and using it when I can't use my big ThinkPad.
Right.
And, you know, it's like, I don't know, 2.8 pounds or something like that, and it's got a carry handle. It's, it's awesome.
Good stuff, man.
Yeah.
We'll try to grab that, and we'll bring Chad over.
Bring it by.
And we'll come by and check out the Intels.
Maybe we can install the Foresight Mobile Edition on it.
Oh, talk to him. Thank you, Ken.
Anyway,
appreciate talking to you. It's nice talking to you again.
Have a good one.
We will. Come on over, Jordan. Say hi real quick.
I'm sorry?
Come say hello real quick.
All right. Hello.
Talking to the mic.
Hello.
So, get a little closer to the mic.
Oh, a little closer,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah.
Okay. How close do I need to be? I don't want to swallow it. I mean, come on.
That was last night.
This doesn't work for me. I just wanted to say real quick, I've got a couple plugs to do. I'm Jordan with the Ubuntu Linux, the local group here in Ohio. And I just want to do quick plugs for Jeremiah Gray. He's the author, if you will, of Hacking and Bankwell. It's basically an LPI comic that you can study and learn from, but it's in the comic book form to learn the LPI exam. He sent us some great swag. We got some stickers from him. We got some flyers. We also had a couple issues a couple copies of issue one for Hackett and Banquo Comics, and let me tell you, it's wonderful stuff. So there's a shout out and a plug for him. If you're interested in it, go to the website, hackettandbankwell.com. Wonderful stuff. And my second plug is for System 76. They have been so gracious to us at the Ubuntu Loco as well as Ohio Linux Fest. They shipped us two of their premier laptops, the 12-inch Darter and the 17-inch Bonobo. Sent them over to us and just to show off Ubuntu and their product, granted, but still. We have some coupon codes here, so if any of the listeners stop by and grab the flyer, check the bottom of it. There's a coupon code for System 76.
Cool. Excellent. Now get the hell out of here.
And sure. They're sweet-looking laptops, too. I went over and looked at them.
Oh, yeah. I got to go check those out. We got someone from the Blender Project coming over.
Oh, boy.
10 minutes.
Okay. That's fine.
A blended 10 minutes.
Yeah, let's fix this for you.
Okay.
How's it going? Just introduce yourself.
It's going great. My name's Roland Hess. I'm on the development team for Blender, which is the world's most popular 3D animation software.
And you guys are the crew behind Big Buck Bunny, Elephant Stream.
Right. Actually, I'm not, well, to say the crew, like from a production standpoint, no,
the Blender
I wasn't.
Foundation.
Exactly. The Blender Foundation. You know, the developers, I did some development work for the software during Elephant's Dream. I also did some of the artwork, too. Not in Amsterdam, unfortunately. That would have been a blast, but family and mortgage. Can't really hang out for 9 months with those guys. Yeah.
That I think we can all understand.
Blender is really an incredible program when you look at it. I mean, it's one of those applications. We talked about this last night at the pre-party. You open it up, and you see this interface with a million buttons.
Yeah,
and you really have no idea where to start. But we talked about interfaces. Some people complain about these complex interfaces. Mm-hmm. But if you want to do something really complex, sometimes you need a complex interface.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to, you know, you're not going to build a car with a hammer.
Right.
You know, and I think a lot of people, you know, and it's fine. A lot of open source enthusiasts, you know, it's a popular project. You want to download it, give it a shot, see what it's about. But, you know, the goal of the tool is focused at dedicated artists. Right. And, you know, unless you're a dedicated artist, not only are you not going to put the time in, there's no reason to put the time in.
We were just talking to Clato before. Clato is big into video editing, and he's worked in the film industry in Hollywood. And he really likes Blender as a video editor.
Yeah. Blender, in addition to being animation and modeling, has like these hidden areas of it as like an integrated compositor. And there's a nonlinear video editor in there. You know, you can do a whole project from every stage of an animation project, from start, drawing storyboards through final editing, right in Blender.
That's great.
Yeah, they've gone, you know, really a lot of attention has been paid in the last year and a half to the video editor. It can do, you can edit high def, think like 720p high def in real time.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's great.
Let me ask you, back to learning Blender, what are some of the tools out there, documentation, tutorials, that people can use to start to get their foot in there and start going with it?
You can always go to blender.org and get a link to the Getting Started wiki there. I have a personal and enduring hatred for the wiki format. So
you're going to share your personal phone number for
for people to yell at me. I know I'm not popular because of that. That's my own personal thing. But the best way to learn it is to get the book, The Essential Blender. That's the getting started guide. And I will say, I'm not plugging that because my name's on the book. I don't get a penny anytime you buy the book. It all goes to the foundation. But the book was developed specifically to take people who know nothing at all about 3D and get them familiar with the tool so that they can actually, you know, make use of the resources on the internet for learning.
So what's next for Blender? Are they, you guys going to do another project like Big Buck Bunny?
Yes, there's another project. It's called Durian, which I guess is some kind of fruit.
It's a nasty-smelling fruit.
Yeah. Okay, well, there you go. See, I didn't know that. I knew it was some kind of fruit, but it's called Project Durian, and it's like an action-adventure kind of thing where there's supposedly going to be photorealistic people. It's to kind of, you know, each project has pushed Blender ahead in one area or another. This one's for special effects. So we're talking like realistic explosions, car crashes, you know, machine guns.
So it's almost like a Hollywood action movie using Blender for like, special effects.
Exactly. Going for like a nonstop action crazy short.
Cool.
That's what's next.
I can't wait to see it.
All right, Roland, thanks for talking to us.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Take care. Let's get Dan on the mic here. Dan is alive, believe it or not. Come on, Dan. Get Chad in here, too.
Really alive.
Come on over, Chad. I'm gonna go take a little break.
Hello?
I'm gonna go say hi to my wife and give her a call.
Hello?
So Dan, let's tell stories about you last night.
I don't know anything about anything last night.
I bet you don't.
Plausible deniability. Plausible deniability. That's what it is.
It was
all about.
A nice long drive yesterday. It wasn't that bad, actually. It was good conversation. Well over.
9 hours door to door. We did all right. That's terrible. My virgin eyes.
I believe so. Are we recording right now, Alan?
We're recording.
That doesn't mean we can't edit it out later if, you know, say something really embarrassing about yourself.
About
of course,
who?
we would leave that in there, but, you know.
About who?
Oh, yeah, whatever, you know. Vaseline boy? Yeah, sure.
You can't say anything about me right now.
Why?
Because I got more on you after last night.
You know what? It doesn't matter.
You literally have stuff on him, don't you, Chad?
Yeah. Is Heaven's Revenge the only guy in IRC?
Probably.
I don't think that we have a mass following in IRC today. There are a couple people that are popping in and out, and some of them hopefully listening to the show to give us a little bit of feedback. I think most of this is going to end up on podcasts.
It was not me. I did not have a video of your ass. I've seen all the videos I took last night. Honestly, I don't think I saw your ass last night, and I'm grateful for it. Did he?
That's what he said.
Oh, so you must have been doing something at the bar last night.
I don't know.
Maybe that was an expression instead of a literal type
of thing. They do say something like
I seen
your
ass yesterday instead of like I seen your ass yesterday, you know?
You know, the last time I got that wasted was in a bar. I actually got kicked out because I went to go use the bathroom, and I went into their office instead.
I remember that, Joe.
And then I got kicked out of the...
You were actually behind the bar last night.
I was?
You remember that?
No,
yeah.
I don't.
Oh, absolutely you were. I looked over, and I'm like, what is he doing? That was at the same time when you were talking to Jono for like an hour. You're actually standing behind the bar.
They let me stand behind the bar?
Apparently they didn't. Yeah.
Was I serving too?
No.
You know what I don't get is how I got out of there and only spent $60.
Wow. Yeah, I spent a good amount too.
And I know I bought drinks for some people, but I only... And then I also have a charge for $4.50.
Maybe they just let you go to get you out, man.
A charge for $4.50?
Yeah.
I just...
Oh, you know what? I forgot I used my credit card last night. I should not have gone back out. I forgot.
Let me double check. Yeah, but that would suck if I was all $455.
Something wrong with the decimal point in there, right?
I'm already in a doghouse anyway, I think.
Why is that? What'd you do?
So we definitely this trip cost a little bit of money.
Check my receipts again.
So you guys haven't seen any of the shows or anything today, huh?
No, been here the whole time.
Hey, I got to see. I saw I went to the Drupal one, which of course I had to go. Hey, I got Drupal in. Look at that. And which actually was really enjoyable. The guy did a good job. Then I saw Ian, which that's him right there, I think. Ian Rabovich or whatever his name is.
Rabinovich.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He did a real nice job about how you can get involved with your local government and
right.
See how they're voting and all that. That was a real good speech.
You see, that's the bad part of doing these, you know, being a podcaster and doing these shows and stuff like that is we come to the shows a lot and we're here as a presence for people to visit us, but we don't normally get a chance to go around and see a lot of the other stuff. One of these days I'm going to come just as a visitor so I can walk around and check stuff out too.
Hey, man, why don't you guys want Ian on?
All right, Ian.
What have you guys been up to? This is Elon.
Who are you?
We've been doing a podcast or two since last we talked, I think.
Yeah, cool.
Did I spend a lot of money last night?
Yeah, you were buying everybody drinks. By the way, Dan's wife, he was buying everybody drinks.
What time was I buying people drinks? You remember?
Towards the end of the evening.
Was that?
Probably around then. I don't know. You wouldn't let me. I know. I had to fight you not to buy me drinks. It was that.
How many people did I buy drinks for?
I think it was just me and Jeremy.
Oh, okay.
And you know, maybe Jono or one or two.
Dead sweating over here.
I'm looking at my receipts.
Am I missing credit card receipts?
I only spent like $60, and I'm trying to figure out how I did that.
No, it's like.
It's the $200 receipt that you're missing that's really
going to
get you.
That's what I'm wondering about. So I'm looking at the times on there. I'm like, okay, 10 of 12 is this receipt.
So for those of you that don't know, Dan's the party animal of the Linux Link Tech Show.
I should relinquish that to somebody else. The last time was off.
He needed somebody to walk him home.
And I don't know who that was.
Yeah, right here.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
He's a hell of a nice guy, you know?
Walking down the middle of the street.
I'm lucky. Oh my God. Now, did you find me in the middle of the street? Or did
I was like, we were walking along, and next thing I know, you're walking down the middle of the street, and I'm still on the sidewalk. I'm like, hey, Dan, you get yourself run over there. You might want to walk over. He's like, and yelled something out like, I don't know what I'm doing. And next thing you know, you were back on the sidewalk.
Was he naked yet, or did that happen afterwards?
That happened up in Jeremy's room, him and Jeremy.
Was I in Jeremy's
room? That's a rumor I heard about the last one.
That was the Boston trip, yeah.
Now Jeremy is.
So we're so we're streaming live here?
Yes, we are.
Is anybody listening?
Probably not.
Somebody's listening. We have 41 people in our chat room, so somebody is listening. Heaven's Revenge, Jay Lindsay. Seriously?
Very cool.
Cyrus. So you flew all the way out here.
From L.A., yeah. Yeah. It's a fun show.
What are your impressions so far of the show? Like, because we haven't had any chance to really walk around and see anybody.
I haven't gotten to see too many presentations because I gave my presentation this morning, and then I've been wandering around the expo floor and talking to people. I like this conference. It's a fun one to go to. I wish they'd had the booths in one spot like they did last year.
Right,
I think that made it a lot easier to run into
people. A little bit more cohesive, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's been a good show. The room I walked into was a little bit more, you know, to present at was a little bit more packed than I'd expected. It was a little nerve-wracking, but it's okay. I think it went okay.
Well, you're a popular guy, man. You know, people want to hear what you have to say.
I don't know about that. Scale's popular. I just happen to be involved with it, among others.
How's the rest of you?
Everything's going well. I'm still at edmonds.com. Mm-hmm. So if anybody's looking for information about cars, edmonds.com is a good place to go. I'm doing J2E admin work there. So Java on Linux, Red Hat. And, you know, doing scale. And then today I gave the presentation about Geek Pack, which is something I'm doing with John Mark Walker and some others. So basically we're putting together a lobbying group for information rights, copyright reform, patent reform, things like that.
And patent reform? I'm not.
Yeah. The patent system's a bit of a mess there.
How about that patent on the dock?
How about the patent on the fork that got approved a couple years back?
On the what?
The fork.
The fork?
There's some guy that, like, he's made his life's work out to be, like, submit.
The patent on peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
It may be. I don't know. I don't know if that's the same guy. But there's some guy who's made his life work to get the most ridiculous things patented. Like, you know, he'll patent the fork or, I don't know. Wouldn't surprise me if he, like, somehow patented the wheel. But so there's been a lot of there's been some good laws that have been passed recently, you know, reforming that. There's the Patent Reform Act of 2007, which made it a little bit clearer, a little bit easier to manage the patent system. But yeah, beyond that, so we're working on becoming an official PAC, a political action committee, to push for these things, and that's needed because, you know, there's the EFF that has a lot of the same positions.
What's your website?
Geekpack.org.
Geekpack.org.
Yeah, there's the EFF and, you know, Public Knowledge and some of these other organizations that have similar positions and similar goals, but because they're nonprofit organizations, they're limited in how much political work they can do and how much lobbying they can do, whereas as a political action committee, your sole purpose is to be political. So there's that, and the other thing we've done is, what I presented about today was our voter information project, which is if you go to geekpack.org, you can look up your senator, your congressman, and see how they voted on some of the issues that apply to you as a technology user. How they didn't vote. What they co-sponsored, what they didn't co-sponsor. So, and
since most people don't realize that their senators don't vote a lot
of the time.
Yeah,
there's a lot of folks that don't bother showing up, yeah. So it's been interesting. It's not an area that I historically knew too much about, but having worked on it, I've gotten to learn quite a bit, so.
Very enlightening.
You're involved with a lot of stuff,
apparently,
man.
Apparently we have an audience now.
Oh, yeah. If you think there's an audience now, wait until 5:15 when we give away all of our swag.
Yeah?
Do our raffle.
So what are we giving away today?
We are giving away a Neuros OSD. Once again, the folks from Neuros Technologies have been really, really awesome and hooked us up with all kinds of stuff. Most specifically, this Neuros OSD version 1 for us to give away. Raffle. And then we have our publishing sponsors, publishers such as O'Reilly and A Press, and of course our good friend Pearson Education.
Yeah.
which has given us this table-long library of books to give away on everything cool you can think of, pretty much. So I expect that we're going to have, we'll have a real hopping joint here around 5:15 when it's time to give it away.
Yep.
Question.
What?
And this has nothing to do with you alone, so.
I'll keep quiet then.
Better. Noose. Nose? Noose? These guys over here, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Are they not running Windows?
They have been for the last couple years.
Is that what I see, a Windows screen?
That's how they do their streaming last couple years. Oddly enough, we managed to be able to do it with only Linux for 267 episodes.
That looks like XMMS from here.
And people will actually hear it later on.
I was wondering, because I see, like, it looks like they have terminals open.
Well, most certainly, I know for certain that last year they were running Windows in order to get their stream out.
No, that looks like XMMS and, like, XChat over there. But
is it Windows or Linux?
Anyways,
it looks like a Linux box from the server perspective. Like it's a big box.
It's a
beige, it says Linux
box
on side,
with
or
with a Vista sticker on it.
Ah,
what'd you call me?
Scale is all about the Vista, right?
Yeah, well, Open Vista if you're talking about medical software, because we co-host the Docs conference, which
I thought Scale was about fishes.
Open source healthcare software. There's a program called Vista that was put together by the federal government. By the, I think it's the Veteran Affairs Office.
Isn't it that new Windows Mojave stuff they've been talking about on TV?
I'm talking about the actual open source Vista that, you know, MedSphere and some other groups are into. But yeah, if you want to run Vista, go have at it.
There was a track at Scale for that, wasn't there?
Yep, Docs. Yeah. Demonstrating open source healthcare solutions. See how I connected that all?
That's getting a lot of publicity.
Yep. Docs? Yeah, it's growing.
But just that whole idea of source.
Yeah, healthcare. Definitely. There's quite a few companies. There's Clear Health, which is a company out of Arizona.
Right.
They've been really kind to Scale, and they've heard good things. MedSphere is one that, you know, they had a little bit of trouble early on, but they've turned themselves around. They're a little bit more friendly to the community these days. There's quite a few others, so it's growing. I mean, hey, if somebody's gonna be in charge of my patient records, do I want them to be stuck in some proprietary system that the doctors can be cut off to at any time, or do I want it in something open source that that they can continue to manage? And if that company goes out of business, they're not up a creek without a paddle.
Sure.
Yeah, there's a lot of about that. A lot of
there actually was a company. There was a company that did some small private practice, you know, medical software. And they stopped providing to some extent. I don't remember what the deal was, but they weren't providing the level of service that people were used to. So doctors stopped paying because they didn't want, you know, they weren't getting the support that they were paying for.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the company locked them out of their software. The serial number expired or what have you, and it came up for renewal, and they couldn't get out their patient records. So
I think there's a good open source project called OpenEMR, if I'm not.
Yeah, OpenEMR is another one.
If I'm not mistaken, we're doing a big EMR rollout at my work.
You work in the healthcare industry?
I work for a medical university, and we're doing a big EMR rollout. And I was talking with some of my coworkers. It's a proprietary thing, of course.
Yeah.
But I was talking with some of my coworkers and crabbing about the fact that it was proprietary, and they said, "Well, you know, what's the alternative?" And I, 10 seconds on Google, whipped up this OpenEMR, which looks like a really good, viable product that they're using and rolling out to some, some smaller, hospitals. And
I vaguely remember speaking with OpenEMR guys and them telling me that they were getting some state level stuff going, but I don't know the details, and I'm not sure what's permissible to say and what's not permissible to say.
Don't know either. I just know that I hit their website and it looked like it was good stuff.
Yeah.
And,
there's a lot of good stuff.
According to the website, not that you can always believe everything on a website, but according to that, it looked like they've been
not personally
doing some good
being in the medical space. I don't know, firsthand how a lot of this software works, but I hear good things from people that are. So
that's really interesting.
So yeah, so we're streaming off this little AT&T USB deal.
Absolutely.
Yes, but that's I don't.
AT&T USB connect, it says?
This is a Sierra Wireless USB
USB connect. I don't have to listen. 881, and basically it's a rebranded Sierra Wireless that AT&T sells, and it works pretty well, man. It's 3G. We got pretty good bandwidth here. We got about 1.8 megabits down and about 350 to 400 kilobits up. More than plenty to stream.
That works pretty well for streaming, then, yeah?
Yeah, the minimum streaming is like, I don't know, maybe 75.
Probably. Probably not
range,
even that.
50 to 100 up. So.
And it works pretty well under Linux?
Oh, it works awesome. All I do is plug it in. It's recognizing the kernel.
Oh, really?
And I like, I have network managers 0.77, which supports 3G cards. Mm-hmm. But I like using WVDIAL.
That's what I'm using.
Because it's so simple to use. You just open up a terminal, fire it up, it works. Boom.
Yep.
Takes like 30 seconds to get it going.
That's what I'm using for my, work has me with a Verizon, Pantech, whatever.
You know what? The only reason why I went with AT&T on this is they don't tie you to a two-year contract.
Yeah.
You can do a pay-as-you-go kind of deal. And as soon as we get back, I'm going to shut it off.
And what's the plan? How much is the plan costing?
It's like $60 a month.
So unlimited?
We'll shut it off, and the next place we go, we'll just turn it back on and... Yep. Be on our merry way.
Yeah. Sounds good to me, man.
Yeah, work sends me off with this one and the Verizon one, so I don't know what it costs, but like today during my talk, there hasn't been internet access here, as you guys know, since you're using this, and mm-hmm. I wanted to demo some of the things we did on GeekPack, so just plugged it in, WVDIAL. I was surprised that some of this stuff was just supported out of the box. I didn't have to do anything, no software install.
That's fantastic, man.
What's awesome is that the kernel hackers, the developers there, they've got the stuff working pretty well, pretty quickly.
Yeah. I'm told that the Sprint cards work just as well. So, AT&T, yeah. Sprint, Verizon, I think it's all just rebranded, same hardware from different, different vendors.
Looking at the vendors, the only reason why I went with AT&T is they seem to be the pay-as-you-go.
Yeah.
They actually let you use your own hardware. So, originally what I wanted to do was there's a card called Huawei, and it works in Linux, okay, but unfortunately it doesn't work well with the network here. I hooked it up, and it was able to connect, and I was able to get the connection going, but it was so slow. It was like dial-up speed slow. So, it's just a configuration on the network issue. It's not really the part.
Either that or, it's also, the reception you get, what kind of signal you got in different areas.
It was horrible.
Yeah.
It was horrible. But this works. I don't know if these guys, I walked away when you came over, Alon. As far as you're doing work with GeekPack, right? That's what you did.
Yeah, so we were talking about a little bit earlier about it. Geek-pack.org. You got to have the dash in there. But we've got our voter information site up that we just launched version 2 of Wednesday night. It's based on MindTouch Deki. So if you're looking for an open source wiki, I know a lot of people are fans of MediaWiki. I used to be too, and then I tried out MindTouch, and I know it sounds like I'm selling for them, but honestly, it made the whole GeekPack thing possible. If it wasn't for that, none of that, I wouldn't have had nearly enough time to put it all together. So it's really extendable. You can script things in the wiki, write extensions to it, pull in data from other places, via whether it be an XML, or other formats. It does it really well. So,
well, professionally, what, you're like a web admin, right?
Officially, I'm a systems administrator for our application operations group at Edmunds.com, and that means that I, my job is supposed to be administrating J2E applications, and that's, mostly of what I do, but I also, somehow find my way into hacking on other things.
Open source philanthropist at large.
Yeah. But, mostly work with WebLogic on top of Red Hat.
Did these guys ask him, sure they did, about scale? How's that coming along?
Scale's coming along pretty well. We're starting to sign up a lot of sponsors and exhibitors. If anybody out there is interested in exhibiting, just shoot me an email, sponsorship@socallinuxexpo.org. And then we also have .org booths available for the for nonprofits, like similar to what they're doing here at OLF. So if you're an open source project and you're looking for a place to promote your work and exhibit, we're happy to help you as well. Shoot me an email and I'll get you in touch with the right people.
Do they charge $90 for plugging in a laptop?
No. So,
I went over and I complained to the OLF crew.
Wait, they're charging you for the power then?
Yeah, not this year. This is the first time that's ever happened.
So I can't really blame the OLF guys for having to charge for those things and for
It's not them. It's the convention center people.
And for not offering the internet access here. Because I remember when we used to be at the convention center, the fee that the LA Convention Center would charge. We used to get our T1, we got a T1 line donated by an ISP 1 year, and the Convention Center charged us $6,000 to let them plug the T1 to the building and then run a Cat 5 cable from the wall to the booth where we wanted to do this stuff. We did the rest. We had our own routers, our own ISP.
You did all the legwork and all the hard work.
Yeah.
They're just collecting the money.
All they did was, you know, plug in from patch A to patch B. It was $6,000. So it's like, it's these places are really expensive.
Yeah, all these convention centers, you know, everything has to be with the union guy. They'll charge $100 to move a box 10 feet because the union guy's got to carry it over.
Exactly. So that's why we moved. That's one of the many reasons we moved away from a convention center. I mean, the thing is that this venue has and the convention center here has that the LA one doesn't, though, which is nice, is that there's a hotel. There's multiple hotels attached to the convention center here.
It's convenient.
So it's convenient. Whereas in LA, you don't have that. You have to walk like 2 blocks from the convention center to any hotel.
Right.
And they're not really all that nice hotels either. Whereas we're at the West End out by the airport, and you just catch a shuttle from the airport. You're there at the hotel where you're gonna stay.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the conference right there. So you get out of your room, get down in elevators, and you're at the show. So we're really happy at the West End. This will be our fourth year there, I think. No, third year.
That's great.
So,
yeah, that's definitely one of the shows we got to go to.
Yeah, if you guys can make it out, I know it's I know travel's tough, but
yeah, we're on the East Coast. You guys are out West. You know,
it's the whole sponsorship thing again. You know, like we don't have any financial sponsors outside of the gracious contributions of our listeners.
Yeah, I mean in kind donations, right?
But you know, even the gracious contributions of our listeners doesn't pay for 4 people to fly to California from Pennsylvania.
Not even close.
You know.
Yeah. So no, that's understandable.
It's just it's an expenditure thing.
Yep.
You need to get a job where they will fly out.
Oh, my job didn't fly me out.
Yeah. You're doing it because you want to.
Yeah. I mean, my job is kind enough to let me take time off. But they don't generally pay for my trips out to open source things.
You go to a lot of the conferences?
I have been the last couple years. This year I managed to arrange for Linux World to be on the same time as I was going to another conference for work. So, I got to check that out. OSCON and Linux Fest Northwest. I mean, the nice thing about a lot of these open source shows is that they're not too expensive.
Right.
So if I have to come out and pay to go to them, or like Linux Fest Northwest doesn't charge, and here I think it's what $60 or something to get in.
Right.
You know,
it's free to get in.
It's free to get in. Sorry, if you want to be a patron, it's $60. That's really reasonable. All you got to do is cover the travel, and you know, I realize that adds up, but you know, it's not like going to, I don't know, some of the commercial, you know, conferences or trainings where it's like $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000 to get
sure.
in the door.
And, right.
You know, just to see the expo floor, you got to pay that much. So
yeah.
it's
much more affordable for regular people.
Yeah.
Peons like us.
Yeah. So.
Cool.
Yeah.
Good stuff, man.
All right, Elon, thanks for coming and hanging out with us.
Definitely.
And talking to us.
Plug it to the mic, Link.
Aw.
No, I was just looking at, I was just trying to
talking
see the time.
In the microphone.
The time?
Yeah, but I thought it was on your thing. Yeah, it's fine.
We're going to wrap it up pretty soon here. We've been going for about an hour and 40 minutes.
Yeah, we're going to have to start.
We're going to wrap it up because we're going to be doing a books raffle pretty soon. Maybe we can get a couple people here standing around. Maybe they want to come on and say hi.
What's
Randy doing now? We're going to get
yes,
Big Randy
sorry,
coming.
Go ahead.
Alan, thanks. We'll talk later, okay? Come on in here, Randy.
All righty.
Have a seat.
Ooh, I'm in the hot seat.
Yeah, just get a little closer.
All right,
we got Randy. Everybody knows Randy. I think you're the new verbal. You call into all these different shows and leave little voicemails.
Yeah,
stuff.
But I'm not leaving temps. I'm not nearly as helpful as them. I'm more of an annoyance. I'm more, you know.
You're like the listener.
Yeah, I'm the I'm the crazy uncle.
Right. No, Randy, you're a truck driver, right?
Yeah, I get to listen to a lot of stuff while I'm
driving.
So
you have plenty of time to listen.
Lots of time.
Do you listen to, like, satellite radio, too, or?
No, you know what? I had a... How much time do we have here?
We got time.
All right. I used to have a satellite radio, but I started listening to podcasts. My progression into Linux, if we got a few, I was kind of go over this on my podcast.
Let's do it.
But, all right. Back in the early days when I was driving, we had XM radio in the truck. And there's a channel that had David Lawrence 24/7 on XM radio. There's David Lawrence. Is that a little bit better?
Yeah.
Here,
how about you can adjust this.
All right. Hold on, everyone. Here.
Hold on a second.
Like that?
There you go.
Oh, okay. Now I don't have to bend down.
There you go. Much better, right?
All right. Well, maybe if it's closer, too.
Yeah, that helps. There we go.
All right.
So who's David Lawrence? I never heard of him.
Well, he's a tech guy. He's
like a Leo Laporte type.
Yeah, he is. And he had a show that was 24/7 on CNET Radio, died off of XM Radio, and he was part of the CNET or part of that programming they had on that one channel. Well, it was David Lawrence 24/7 for about 6 months, 9 months. Well, David Lawrence was talking about how you could use iTunes to grab Battlestar Galactica movies,
right?
And Heroes, I think it was. So I got iTunes. I've been playing around with Fedora Core 6. Had a bad incident with that prior to this. Okay.
So this is on what, Windows?
Yeah, this is back with my Windows systems. And I had tried, around that time, I had tried Fedora Core 6. Wi-Fi wouldn't work. I'm trying to run Wi-Fi on a desktop in a big truck, in a truck stop, where Wi-Fi is the only thing I can get online with.
Right.
It's a fail. Well, then I find out David Lawrence. I get iTunes. I find the Linux Reality Show with Chess Griffin.
Right. We know Chess, a good friend of ours.
Right, exactly. And through Chess, I found your show and the myriad of other Linux podcasters. And somewhere along the line, I read an article about Ubuntu and DistroWatch, and I now have a laptop to bring it up full speed. No longer have the XM radio, no longer have iTunes. I'm running Ubuntu for my desktop on a laptop and using Amarok to pull down most of my podcasts and stuff.
So you're basically a hardcore at the podcast. Now you have a lot of time sitting in the truck.
Oh, good God, yes.
You drive a lot. My brother-in-law, Craig, used to be a truck driver.
Right.
And he would drive cross-country back and forth, up and down, all over the place.
Right, right.
And, you know, you go out for... He would be out 3 weeks out of a month.
Sure, that's
road.
About what I have. And I got kind of messed up. I was out in Utah last weekend, and I sat out there for about 48 hours before I started heading back out east, and I was hoping to get back towards home, which is up by Cleveland.
So you live in Ohio?
Yeah. I have an Ohio address, and to... I was going to go up to Cleveland, grab my minivan, then come down here. Well, time got so short, and my dispatcher, he's trying hard for me. There's a clerical error as to why I couldn't make it. Now I have a load that got me here. I got my tractor parked.
So you got your truck here?
Yeah, my tractor's parked in one of the big lots here. There's a big lot parking, the east lot. If anyone wants to come here with a big truck or big vehicle, it's the east lot.
I'm looking to bring my school bus next year.
The east lot. Yeah. Is it a pink one?
No. It's a yellow school bus.
Okay.
So,
Randy, how many days a week are you actually out on the road?
I can have a little bit of decision on that one. It's usually 2 weeks, 2 weeks to 4 weeks, because for making it back to see my kids, try to do that, but sometimes 3 weeks.
3 weeks straight?
Yeah. My brother-in-law used to be a truck driver, and he used to do the same thing.
I have worked like 18, 20 days in a row with not a day off. Maybe a short – there's short days mixed in there, 1 hour, 2 hour, 4 hours, something like that. But
Have they put like regulations in place? Because
yeah, you drive 10 hours and you can drive – excuse me. You have to – okay, you start your day. You have 14 hours to complete your day, and within that 14-hour period, you can only drive 11 hours. Then you have to take a 10-hour break. But I'm trying to get out of the trucking thing. I mean, I don't mind being the Linux trucking kind of a guy, but, you know, I'm trying to get back into IT. I worked, you know, as field service.
Because the money is good in truck driving.
Not really.
See, my brother-in-law did it. He liked the money. He thought it was decent, you know, compared to what he was doing.
I don't know. It's $40,000 a year eating out of restaurants, living in a truck all year long.
I don't know how much exactly he was making.
And well, maybe people were making the same amount of money 10 years ago.
His big issue, he got carpal tunnel syndrome.
Right.
And he was away from his kids. And, you know, those two main things, he had to get surgeries on his wrists. And being away from the family, that was the end of that for him. So he stopped being a truck driver. He's doing all this stuff.
Right.
Now.
So. But yeah, I've as far as podcasting, in fact, I enjoyed podcasts so much I started doing one of my own.
Well, what's the website for that?
Randomizedradio.com, and I'm working on as to where I'm hosting it. Well, that's the main link, and I'll point it if it's not the real one in the future. Excuse me. And if you get to the site, use the Feedburner site, which will always be pointing at the correct feed. But basically, I chat about different ideas, and I have about four. My format that I'm going to try to work with is maybe 10, 20 minutes of me chatting, maybe going down the road, right, different ideas. And I'm getting set up to get the call-in, the number, that's Grand Central number. I'm trying to get a Grand Central type number.
So people can call you.
Absolutely. Because I do. That's why I call the podcasts. I listen to the podcasts going down the road. They have a call-in number. I have it already locked in my phone. Rather than sending an email, I'm going down the road. You know, I'll call somebody up and leave a little comment.
Right. That's kind of cool.
Well, it's the way it works for me.
So on your show, what do? You playing music? You talking?
PodSafe music from usually
what style? Rock,
yeah. Classic rock, okay. Classic hard rock. Usually, I'll say, you know, I have a little intro, welcome to my podcast intro, and then usually I start off with something that's nice and loud. I like, you know, let's wake up.
How long is it? What do you do? Like an hour or?
I'm trying to keep it around 45 minutes or less. I'm trying to keep it underneath there. It's, you know, depending on the length of the songs and stuff. When Richard Wright from
Pink Floyd,
thank you, died. I did a little bit of a tribute to him. It's hard trying to find some good music that I could play that was legal to play on.
I was going to say Pink Floyd. It's not really.
Well, there's a tribute band, and and they did a couple of cuts. They actually had some videos, and I grabbed the soundtrack off their AVIs and played them. And there's other bands that do cover songs.
That's the biggest thing with people that do podcasting in general, is that the music, you're very limited. Unless you're going to start paying royalties to like, you know, mainstream music, you really legally you can't play that music. So that leaves us to go to, you know, quote unquote pod safe music. You know, websites like that, Magnitude, what's the other one? I forgot the other music site. That's you know, like free, open kind of.
The Internet Archive?
Well, that's one, yeah, too. There's another one, too. I can't remember it. It's on. It begins with a J. If you have like Rhythmbox and stuff, you can find music through there. Jamendo.
Is that PodSafe also?
I think it might be.
Because there's. I try to keep everything on the up and up, and so far I don't think I've played anything. There's a couple of songs that National Guard did with Kid Rock and Three Doors Down.
Right.
I had those on there because I have a friend of mine who was in the military that I did kind of a tribute. Sometimes I focus on a person or a friend on a podcast. I have different ideas that I throw out. I mean, I'd like to see a modular car come out. That was we were talking earlier today at the conference with some other people. And I think the basic thing for a modular car would be a frame.
Uh-huh.
Like a
kit, you mean?
Well, yeah, I guess, because I don't know if we could get a big company to do it, but if we had a frame that you could replace all the body parts on and the engine parts, you know, you could change the type of engine, make it bigger, smaller, electric, gas, hydrogen.
So you can customize it to a certain degree.
Absolutely, but you start with the same frame, the same body. It's everything's easy to take apart. We make it for the man, you know, the garage mechanic, or not even a garage, or the shade tree mechanic. Sorry, wrong term. The
gearhead.
Yeah, you don't even have to be a major gearhead to be able to change these things on out. But if we had, I'd like to make a frame out of titanium because of the rust problem. If you had a frame, because how often do we have cars that are really, you know, deserve going into the graveyard when we just would like something fresh? If we had an older car and the inside of the interior is getting, you know, screwed on up, why not have a vehicle that you could replace the interior or replace your seats?
Kind of like a Bugs Lab kit with cars.
Absolutely, Bugs Lab kit, VW type thing. But, you know, I know a titanium frame would be a little bit too expensive, but it wouldn't rust. Or a composite, if we use some of the composites are coming out these days too. But I figure if someone come out with something like that, maybe there'd be some garage industry or the home industry of maybe manufacturing dashboards that have really cool things like Bug Labs,
right,
and Linux servers built into them with cameras and GPSs, and you know, you have chairs. You could do all kinds of different things with that. You can make modifications to it that would be open. I think that'd be a great idea. It might not happen via Detroit, but just like Jesse James and his modified motorcycles out there, the West Coast.
That's like a big business, custom choppers.
Yes, it is. Well, why can't we do that with cars? Because the motorcycle...
Well, the whole thing with custom choppers is because they're handmade product. They're very expensive.
Well,
you know, not everybody has 80 grand to spend on a motorcycle.
That's true. But if you had a custom car or something like
that... It would have to be economical. That's the thing, the whole price point thing.
Well, we start off with something economical, and then you add your bling to it later. You know, right. you buy this car for your kid in high school, or for yourself, and they can keep the frame for their lifetime and modify it, change it all along the way. Something that's rust proof. I don't know. It's just an idea. But those are the kind of random ideas that I have. What about 12 volt lightings? If we had 12 volt lighting in our houses using batteries and LEDs. Why can't we do that? You know, I'm just to get off the grid.
The whole thing with that is it's the whole price thing. You know, personally, I would love to like have a solar cell array on the top of my house and not be, you know, taking power from the power company.
Right.
The thing is, though, is that the level how efficient it is very low right now, and it's so damn expensive to have it done.
Yes, it is.
We're talking $50,000-$60,000 just to put a solar cell array up on my roof.
Well, have a Bug Labs idea. I like to pimp them. They're really neat. I want one
cool
of those.
Stuff,
I want one for Christmas. Santa, get me one for Christmas, please.
Hint, hint.
Wherever you may be, yes. But have something of a Bug's Lab idea. I like the modular Legos. I mean, I love Legos and erectile
systems. Everybody play with
right?
Legos and erectile
right.
systems.
Well, why can't we do that in the real world, you know, as adults? I mean, that's the bicycles I used to ride as a kid. I wanted bigger tires. Well, it wasn't until someone older than me made a mountain bike.
Right.
You know, back in the 70s when I was a kid, there was no mountain bike. I had a Schwinn Varsity, I think it was.
Right.
Was that?
And then the mountain bikes came out, like the Mongooses and the Huffies and then the other ones.
Oh, I had a bicycle. It was a Raleigh that the frame on it broke right in the very front. Poof. It separated. And I was going up and down hills that day, which freaked them out. But back to the solar stuff. But you're right. It is expensive. So if someone did...
Plus, it's not very efficient yet to the point where it makes sense to do it.
It can or can't, because being in the big truck, okay, coming from the big truck or someone that's been in RVs, you look and see how much stuff we've got that's running off of 12 volts. We could actually, I really think if someone took their time, and I don't have an office to really try this and spend the money on it to make proof of concept, but using some of these low-power machines such as the OpenMoco.
It's going back to the whole open hardware concept.
Well, I have that open source, absolutely. But if you had, you're right about the lighting, but if our lighting right now for our houses, from what I understand, they estimate your lighting is 50% of your electric bill. Well, if you could take a solar power with two 12-volt batteries that provided LED lighting or
it's fluorescence.
Fluorescence, thank you. You have that running off those. And that provides enough lighting in the house, and maybe there's enough lighting going into the other bedrooms. You could at least try getting yourself off of the main grid and no longer, you know.
Yeah, I understand. Like, personally, to me, if they were able to get it to, say, a 3-foot square grid that you could put on a portion of your roof.
Yeah.
And that would give you enough power to run your house.
No, not
all the time.
That won't be enough for your house, but I'm thinking just for the lights in, say, your living room and garage. Let's try with proof of concept. Start a little bit of a time.
Right.
See, that what I'm thinking is maybe these widgets that I want to make, these lighting widgets, 12-volt lighting widgets.
Right.
Maybe you would have one panel on above the roof of your bedroom, one above your roof in your living room, and it would provide it for those rooms that you use the most. Not removed totally off the grid, but we would be...
Supplement it.
Well, weaning ourselves off of that electric nipple.
Right, I see what you're saying. Well, hopefully the technology progresses to the point where that becomes feasible.
Well, I'd like to get out of the truck to where I could actually start putting these things into play.
Do you have any like electronics background or?
Not really. As a kid, I always bought the little red boxes from Radio Shack.
Oh yeah, make the little radios.
Yeah, I love those and all the 101 kits. Yeah, I had those. The first time I saw a little small tape recorder, I thought they could have made a Walkman out of that. But it wasn't until 15 years later, that Sony actually did that. But the there's that. But as far as electronics, not really. I'm just kind of a gadget
like
person.
A tinker.
Yeah. My hero's Thomas Edison. He's actually who brought us multimedia. He's the first one that recorded anything on the wax cylinder, and he brought us movies. Thomas Edison brought us the multimedia besides some innovations for the phones and other electrical items.
Cool. Well, good luck with it, man.
Thanks a lot. You ready for someone else in here?
I don't know. I think we're going to wrap it up. We've been going for almost 2 hours now.
Woohoo!
And I think we're gonna wrap it up for now. We're going to take a little break. I don't know if we're going to do another episode or not tonight. We may or we may not. Maybe we'll do something a little shorter. Maybe we'll go out to dinner with a bunch of guys and we'll just pass the mic around and chit-chat for a little bit.
Awesome.
So I'm gonna say goodbye to everybody. We enjoyed Ohio Linux Fest. Thanks for listening. We'll see you soon. Hopefully there's another episode today. If not, you'll hear us on Wednesday. Thank you, everybody. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
When I saw that fat man keel over and die, Michael, we don't have a lot of time on this earth. We weren't meant to spend it this way. Human beings were not meant to sit in little cubicles staring at computer screens all day, filling out useless forms and listening to 8 different bosses drone on about mission statements.
We find it's always better to fire people on a Friday. Studies have statistically shown that there's less chance of an incident if you do it at the end of the week. What would you say you do here?
Well, look, I already told you. I deal with the goddamn customers so the engineers don't have to. I have people skills. I am good at dealing with people. Can't you understand that? What the hell is wrong with you people?